Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unafawakin.
This week, Amazon jumps on streaming music, an Oculus Rift for Samsung Mobile, the co-founder of Pirate Bay is arrested, the NSA collects millions of faces online, Google to launch satellites for global broadband, and of course, all the latest from Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you go there, please write us, give us some feedback, write comments in our show notes, leave us a review on iTunes. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com, and our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Tonight, because we've got such a huge topic here with the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference, we're just going to jump right into it right off the gate. It's the hottest story of the week. So every year at this time, Apple leads the keynote at its Worldwide Developers Conference, which is specifically meant for developers. And this year, Apple used the conference to update developers on the latest version of its desktop and mobile operating system. Let's start right off the bat with OS X 10.10, codename Yosemite, as is the new nomenclature for California landmarks. And let me just run down some of the features that they highlighted about OS X Yosemite. It's got a new design. They have a new notification center. Spotlight has changed. They've incorporated continuity features, a feature called handoff, instant hotspot. SMS and phone calls can now be received on OS X. Mail, a markup feature for mail, a new Safari, iCloud Drive incorporated into it. AirDrop now works between iOS and Macs, and it's going to be free in the fall when it's released. Going down some of those features. Let me ask you guys, what were your favorite highlights of their announcement of OS X Yosemite?
Right. So I look at OS X, and I think for me, the two big things were continuity and Spotlight. I really like what they're doing with Spotlight. Continuity is something I know that you and Tosin want to talk about a little bit more, but with the Spotlight stuff, for a lot of that functionality, this kind of like, I quickly want to search. I quickly want to find something. You know, that's been in Macs for a while. But now with some of these new things that they've put in, like third-party widgets or even the conversions that happen, mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff you can get done without having to open up yet another browser tab. It's just built right into the operating system. And while it's kind of not a big deal, if you're a person who's a tab whore like me, I'm using tabs for everything. It's hard to keep track of stuff.
Yeah.
That's really comforting. Right?
So Spotlight, like what they did when they announced their update of Spotlight is, it's essentially like Google's instant search feature, except for the desktop and Apple, of course. Like you start to type in a few letters, and it immediately brings up contextually everything that's in your desktop related to what you're searching.
Or on your iCloud instances. So like basically Spotlight's been on the... You know, it's been on the Mac for a while, but it's really strong on the phone because the phone doesn't have access to all. Like, it's hard to get to all the folders. You've got multiple pages. You've got this. You've got that. So what's really great is that they've got this this functionality that now really takes advantage of everything that's on there. And they've built in these calculators, like conversion calculators, like whatever. And the idea that you can just drag results right into your documents from the results box is also super convenient. I mean, it was obviously a really well-done presentation, mm-hmm. but the functionality is just those little things built into the OS, kind of like when you get a new car and there's like that little feature that you like that really makes me sort of like, oh wow, I think OS X could be my primary system now. There's also a lot of stuff going on with Safari that was exciting. Most important to me was this idea of the super fast Java, obviously, but then on top of that, the way it deals with tabs, that was exciting too. They've managed to put together that old school Safari look with a million kind of thumbnails of the tabs,
mm-hmm.
yet have it more cogent, more together,
you can have
it.
Like just, groups of tabs laid out visually.
Groups of tabs laid out in a way that makes more sense than sort of like mm-hmm. the blast of 50 different boxes right. that are thumbnails
and,
of what
and
you
can
had
scroll through them visually, mm-hmm. much yeah. like you can on iOS now.
Yeah, yeah, and that's,
and easier to be able to ascertain which specific tab you want. At a glance, as well as to know to distinguish which tabs that you have available from your various devices. So I think that is also one of the more powerful things for me as well. I think for me specifically, it's, you know, I'm a crazy tabber in all my windows. I must have, you know, 30 plus tabs.
30? I'm at like 150. It's terrible.
Something ridiculous. And having that sort of continuity and the ability to see it from all my various devices at a glance, as well as the speed. Because for me, speed is everything when it comes to using the web. So we'll see how it actually performs in real situations.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty powerful stuff, if what they say is true. And the other thing that Dwayne, you mentioned briefly, that really caught my eye was the continuity features. I think that's that's always huge. Apple has done a little bit of it, and this is sort of in the same vein that Google allowed with searching on your browser when you're logged in. Mm-hmm. You get those same sort of results from your phone and a car. That stuff has always been pretty amazing, but taking it a little further, at least in the Apple sphere, is going to be great, because that is going to really integrate very nicely with all the other iOS devices and cause me to want more
devices. The other iOS devices, the OS X to iOS connection is really the big thing. So it doesn't just happen between iOS devices. I mean, we've already had some continuity between the iOS devices. You could always pull out your iPad and see the tabs you had open on your iPhone, that kind of thing. Continuity is a suite of services that are now built into OS X that support iOS.
Handoff.
So there are a couple things in the suite. The first one is this SMS and phone calls on all your devices.
Mm-hmm.
Super
mm-hmm.
convenient. Basically, we've all been there. You are on your iPad. You want to send a message to somebody. You realize they're on a different type of device than an iOS device, so you can't send an iMessage. You have to go find your iPhone and then, you know, do that. They're using the iPhone as a relay now. So if the iPhone is anywhere in your house and you get a text message and you're on your Mac, you know, based on what iCloud thinks is active, it's mm-hmm. going to send you the message on your Mac, whether it's an iMessage or a text message. That's tight. Telephone calls are the same way. You can both receive and initiate phone calls from your Macintosh based on the fact that you have an iPhone, and it's going to talk to your iPhone based on your iCloud account. Also very tight. So that's piece number one of continuity. Piece number two, the instant hotspot. You've got a Mac, you've got you've got an iPad, mm-hmm. and you've got an iPhone. It recognizes what you own. If your phone is around, it's going to instantly connect to your phone to make a hotspot if you've set that up. And you don't have to do a lot of setup. You don't have to type in a password. You don't have to do anything. It just knows because you got the same iCloud ID attached to it. AirDrop between iOS and Mac.
Yeah.
So basically it used to be that if I'm standing next to Tosin and he's got his iPhone and I've got my iPhone, he took a picture, he could pop up an AirDrop, and if my system said I was available, he could just drop me a photo. I'd be like, oh, great, I'll take the photo, I'll take the video, I'll take whatever. They've extended this to work between iOS and Mac. And this is really
I
a
actually
big deal.
Didn't know that you couldn't do that. Like, I hadn't tried it, but I was not aware that you could not do between iOS and Mac.
Right, and that's it's so intuitive that you'd be able to do it, and you can't. what's really good about this feature is, I don't know about you guys, but I'll do something like take a couple pictures of an item I'm going to put on Craigslist or eBay or something. And then, you know, I might do something, you know, I can wait for iCloud to sync up or whatever, but I might do something as silly as email myself the picture so I can work it on my desktop. Now I don't have to. Now I just bink and it's, you know, I can airdrop it over and that's tight. I'm pretty sure that you'll be able to airdrop stuff, you know, within your own iCloud account pretty quickly and seamlessly without having to like accept it necessarily. But the big deal I think that everyone's excited about is the handoff functionality. And this is basically this thing where if you're working on something on your Mac and you pick up your iPad or iPhone and, you know, activate the device, there'll be an icon sitting there on the lock screen that will allow you to take that software that you've been working on or that document that you've been working on and open it up with the relevant software on the mobile device and vice versa. Right now it seems to work with Apple's first party applications, Numbers, Keynote, you know, that sort of thing. I'm sure Notepad, you know, their notes app and everything else. But, you know, like so many other things, they start with themselves and they move it on to developers once they get a sort of software development kit piece around it. So it's pretty exciting to be able to just hand that kind of stuff off. You're working – this is really, really a big deal for email. I don't know how many times I started an email response on my telephone and then I realized, hey, you know what? This is bigger than I thought it was going to be. I better get to my computer.
Yep.
I get up there. I delete the user that it was supposed to be sent to. I send it to myself so I can open up my computer and then use it. And everybody knows that is a pain point.
It's a workaround.
Yeah, it's a workaround. And they you know, Apple's all about, like, if Apple can remove the workarounds, you can get more work done.
Yeah.
And that's really a big piece here. I mean, I know you guys are excited about handoff. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, Walt Mossberg of Recode wrote an article that essentially said he basically said that the key point of Apple of this WWDC in relation to the continuity and handoff is really just to keep you in Apple's world, to make sure that you never have to leave the Apple ecosphere.
And yeah, but you know, they've always worked in that vein. It's always been about that. When the iPod first came out, the iPod only worked on Apple devices. iTunes didn't work on Windows. When AirPlay is a huge thing, and AirPlay was only an Apple thing, right? And that definitely kept me locked in to the Apple ecosphere. And then you got PhotoStream, another thing out there that helped me into that stuff. Because with PhotoStream, I suddenly didn't have to think about any of my photos. They were all going where they needed to go. So this is an ongoing process for Apple. This isn't something new. And while I think, you know, Mossberg, his writing's always good, for me, there's a little bit of Captain Obvious there.
This is huge for me, handoff, for all the reasons that you discussed. It's just basically, I don't want to do any workaround. I want to be able to just jump from device to device, and I'm constantly jumping from device to device as it is. And this just makes the process easier, so I don't have to decide where I'm going to start working and decide if I'm going to finish working on that same device.
That takes up mental space. And what Apple's really doing is they're recognizing the fact that these mobile devices aren't just things you sync up with your computer anymore. They are devices in and of themselves. They are, you know, and because you can't get to the file system. It's not a question of I saved it on Dropbox. Let me open it up on this other computer. Mm-hmm. They're basically doing the workarounds for you in these ways that are relatively intuitive and pretty seamless. This is going to be a big win because that's that magic feeling. I know that they haven't introduced a new product in a while, or whatever. But this update to OS X, this continuity thing, it's really what we've been waiting for. It's what people have been waiting for since the smartphone became the default device. Get on your computer, got to get what was on my smartphone. Boom, it's right there.
Yeah, I mean, the post-PC era, right? Making sure that your knowledge workers can, you know, work from anywhere at any point and be able to switch around, because that's what we do on a day-to-day basis. how many tech devices do you touch each day that you, you know, from your phone to your various laptops to your various iPads, you know, this is like a good functionality ad.
Yeah, because, I mean, you mentioned that, but I think about it. I was sitting, you know, in front of my laptop. There was another, you know, it's attached on the screen. I had, I have an older iPad sitting next to me that was just getting breaking news headlines regarding WWDC. And then I had my actual iPad playing the video as I was writing and doing some work. There's a lot of devices going on.
Yeah.
In my life. And it's just better to not have to think about where your data is. Because the whole thing was, I mean, you look at how Apple's been doing the cloud, and it hasn't been that impressive for quite some time. And if this is their vision of the cloud, making it so that you don't even notice the cloud, but it's working for you, then that's not a bad vision. That's a vision that that people can get behind, especially mm-hmm. geeks like me who are critical of everything.
I want to talk about a couple other features in the new OS X 10.10 Yosemite. One of them is mail markup. Now, this is an answer to a problem that I didn't realize that I needed. But once I saw it, I'm like, this should have been the way it always is. And essentially, what it is...
That's the best kind of thing to hear if you're a developer.
Yeah. Yeah, so when you attach... when you have attachments in mail, you can now mark up those attachments with your own annotations, whether it's drawn or typed or using captions or arrows. There's another popular app called Sketch that sort of does the same functionality and had done the same functionality that I was not aware of up until now. But this is something that I constantly, while I'm putting an attachment on someone's email, I'm constantly going, okay, I wish I could just, you know, draw an arrow here or write on it somehow. And now here it is. So it's kind of big for me.
Yeah, it is. It isn't a small thing. I've always had this functionality with Adobe's Acrobat. I have Acrobat Pro. I always use it. But you have to get that attachment. You have to download it. You have to put it into Acrobat. And then you've got to go and like do some work. You've got to know the actual system, the Acrobat system, in order to get those things done right, those annotations, those notes, those things. This is more intuitive. On Windows right now, there is a tool called Snapshot, I think, and Snipping Tool. And Snipping Tool allows you to take a picture of something and quickly draw on top of it, and that's a big deal. Being able to do that directly from your mail is pretty tight. So this is something that I think people are going to – once people get clued into it, it's going to be one of those aha moments at work for your boss or whoever you do it right in front of. Oh, snap, how'd you do that? It's going to become a big thing, and others are going to follow.
Should we mention iCloud Drive?
iCloud Drive, yeah. So this is something that kind of – slides right into that space, like Dropbox space. We mentioned just now that the cloud, Apple's, you know, rendition of the cloud has not been a wild runaway success. They weren't first to the game, and to date, they haven't showed us a lot that was awesome about it. When you look at people like what Google was doing, Google Drive, or what Dropbox or Box was doing with syncing the documents directly to your desktop, etc. Apple avoided that. Under Steve Jobs, the idea was everyone gets to files via apps. There's no reason to actually give people access to a cloud-based file system. It's going to become too messy, whatever. Tim Cook has taken this in a different direction. And what we're seeing is the ability to have your files stored online for pretty reasonable sums of money. I mean, right now, you're spending $50 a year for 40 gigs of iCloud space. You're spending $40 a year for 20 gigs of iCloud space right now.
Yeah.
Next year, once iOS 8 comes out, you'll be spending something like $50 a year for 200 gigs of iCloud space. That's enough space for your entire music collection for most people. That's enough space for, you know, basically a bunch of pictures, all these things. So you can really get into what you want to store in the cloud, and you never have to think about it. And that is going to be tight. This also really helps when it comes to the fact that Apple's desktop computing devices have pretty small storage allocation. So you're buying a new laptop, you've got 512 gigs on it. That's a big difference from the sort of like, you know, 2 terabytes that you're able to get on a laptop if you don't get an SSD in there. So they're really going to solve a pain point here. And just like Dropbox, you're not going to have to think about it. Dropbox is a very good cross-platform system. We'll see if iCloud Drive allows, you know, I think it does allow Windows, but we'll see how seamless it is. I know I've had some trouble with the iCloud control panel in Windows myself. So, go back to Walt Mossberg. It's lock-in, and it's a smart way to do it. And they're finally catching up with the way other guys are doing it.
Yeah. One of the other things I wanted to ask you guys about in before we move on to iOS is, what do you guys think about the new look, sort of the flat iOS-inspired design?
I think after a year of iOS 7...
Yeah.
Okay, sure. Go ahead. Do it. It's catching up. They want it to all sync up. It looks fine. I don't look at it and think, oh man, it's so beautiful. I mean, it's Apple. It's going to be pretty. It's
no,
pretty.
But did you think that it was derivative? They shouldn't.
I think they did a good. They struck a good balance between not throwing out the baby and updating it so that the skeuomorphic aspects of it were gone.
Yeah.
You know, the drop shadows that were so big in the 90s are now, you know, they've been done away with. The music app is now red instead of blue. They've kind of just updated it. And while they focused on things like fonts and things and so on, I'm sure that's on some level that's going to make the experience more sedate. But I don't know that it's blew me away. You know, I don't know that I'm such an aesthetic person that needs to have all my fonts be super thought of, but I'm glad someone's thinking about it.
Do you want your desktop to look like a mobile device, or do you
So I do think that they haven't actually made the desktop look like a mobile device. I think it still very much looks like a desktop mm-hmm. device. It reflects some of the look and feel of the iOS 7, and I guess what iOS 8 will look like. But I didn't really feel as if it was a bland copy, or that they were taking away. There's still an Aqua feature. It still uses blue in those ways. It seemed familiar but updated. It didn't seem like they just threw it all out and went for iOS. It definitely seemed incremental. It's a big change, but it's still an increment from kind of doing it all over again. What I really liked was the ability to turn all those white menus black, because
right, the dark mode.
Yes, exactly. Because if I'm sitting upstairs in my study, and I'm, you know, I've got all the lights out, and I'm just kind of focused on what I'm writing, uh-huh. you know, that brightness is a problem. There are a couple cool apps on OS X now that'll actually use red light instead of blue light coming out of your Mac in order to make your late night experience better on your eyes and better on your like circadian rhythms and so on.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really have a preference, to tell you the truth. It was more like, oh, they changed it. It looks fine to me. I don't think it's worse or better. I think it's, you know, it's an adjustment, and I'm okay with it. It's not jarring.
It's like some of the criticism that has come about both OS X and iOS over the last few years is that instead of being the innovators that is their reputation, they are now following some of their competitors. And you could argue
absolutely. There's no doubt. I think these things are absolutely correct.
You could argue that the mobilization of the desktop follows Windows OS X with the Metro interface.
Oh, Windows.
I mean,
8.
I'm sorry, Windows. Yes, Windows 8 with the Metro interface.
So I think that Apple has followed in a few things, but I don't think that that's a correct judgment. So they followed on the small form factor tablet. They followed on music and streaming services. They followed – if this phone comes out 4.7 inches, even the 4-inch phone that they have, they followed on larger phone sizes. They followed on all those things. But when it comes to the operating system of the desktop having mobile feelings, mobile attributes – Back to the Mac happened during Steve Jobs' lifetime, so I think 2011. That was 3 years ago. And that was when they introduced OS X Mountain Lion, and it had all these features that were completely represented, reminiscent of iOS, right? In fact, when you look at iOS, you know, iOS was derived from OS X, and then back to the Mac, that keynote, that that showed how they were just bringing some features back into it. So suddenly you got the two-finger swipe from the right side to the left side, and you get that kind of news feed and notification center and the Twitter. You can tweet from there and do Facebook and all that stuff. Right. That stuff, bringing that to the desktop, was bringing it from iOS. So I don't think that by saying, oh, Windows 8 came first with that, that's not true when you look at the actual facts. Windows 8 did a heavy, heavy dive right into the Metro-like interface.
Sure. They went all in, as they say.
They went, exactly. They went all in, and I think that hurt them on some level. They was like, hey, we're going to do this, and people are going to like it or whatever.
What else could they do, really? I mean, they really could. It was either
gonna go that far.
It was either evolve or die for Windows.
Yeah, I mean, they took an app. I mean, Windows themselves took an Apple approach, saying we're gonna shift our paradigm in a significant way, and some stuff is gonna fall by the wayside. We're not gonna be completely backward compatible with everything. They did an excellent job of maintaining the level of backwards compatibility that they did, but I don't think that saying. Again, I don't think that's saying that Apple copied Windows, OS X copies Windows by bringing UI, you know, functionality and attributes from their mobile operating system. That's just not the case. Apple didn't copy Windows. Apple and Windows are doing this convergently together, you know, independently.
It's the global trend is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Anything else about the OS X before we jump into the iOS changes?
I really can't stress enough how awesome it is that you can get a phone call on your, or you can phone call through your iPhone from your computer. And I really got to say, for the last 5-6 years, I've been sitting in front of my computer on a, you know, I find a web page for a restaurant. It's time to call them. And Skype used to let me do it before a fee, right?
Yeah.
So, but I had to have a Skype plugin, and it was for a fee. And that was annoying.
Didn't Google Voice used to do the same thing?
I don't know if I had a plugin for Google Voice on that. But I do know that with Skype, because that was what I usually use for talking on my computer, I could do that. And that was, you know, it was all right, but it wasn't great. And it would crash every once in a while. Just because when you have plugins are always, you know, it doesn't matter how good your plugin is. The browsers change so quickly now, you can't keep up. So that's a really big deal, being able to talk from my computer as a speakerphone. That's huge. Another thing that I do like is Apple has talked to Netflix and a couple other providers of content, and their new codec for movie streaming, for video streaming, allows Safari to play videos without installing Microsoft Silverlight or any other third-party plug-in to your browser if you're using Safari. So now they claim you get 2 hours more video playback because it's just so efficient. That's impressive. As a person who often uses my iPad for the movie watching, just because I know it's going to burn the battery of my desktop computer, my laptop, this is something that makes me think twice when I get my next laptop, thinking, hey, I could get that MacBook Air at 13 inches and know that I'm going to have really tight battery life if I decide to watch a video on a plane or video when I'm out or whatever, you know. It's huge.
All right, let's jump into the iOS discussion here. The desktop OS isn't the only thing Apple updated this year. They also announced iOS 8 for mobiles, and I'm just going to run down some of the features that they mentioned, and we'll talk in depth about some of our favorites. Notification Center it was updated with the quick access features there. QuickType, which is the new version of the keyboard in iOS 8, context sensitive. Once again, continuity as part of the whole software ecosystem. iMessage with media replies in iMessage. Enterprise, some enterprise features, making it easier to incorporate enterprise on iOS. HealthKit or Health, and we'll get into that, I'm sure. Family sharing, which lets you sync up all the devices in a single family. They updated their photos to allow greater storage and smart editing features. Siri has been updated. So what was your guys' favorite features from iOS 8? And I'll start with Tosin this time.
I think one of the features that I actually really enjoyed hearing about was QuickType. Now, for me, you know, I actually use a lot of the text-to-speech capabilities.
Yeah.
And those actually work pretty well. But I kind of like the ability that based off of, and for those who are not aware of how QuickType works, it's really based off of who you're communicating with. It will suggest the next word or next series of words to complete the conversation that you're having. And depending on sort of your diction and prior interactions with that person, it will learn the types of words that you'll use or types of phrases and use those within its filling capability. And the other interesting thing about it is it does it completely on the device. There is no synchronization with anything external to sort of protect you from that. But I thought that was pretty interesting, pretty cool, because you're getting messages out faster. For me, I'm always on the go, you know, be it in the office, running around, or you know, going out to try and fix other things outside of work. And so anything that lets me convey my messages quicker or schedule things or do things of that nature, that's a positive in my book. And another thing under the same vein is the notification center change. For me, the notification center as it currently stands is not the greatest thing for.
Because you get the notification and then you still have to like swipe and then type in your password and then go to the, you know, program that's.
Yep. And here now I can just reply directly and without having to leave the context I'm in. So I think that that's like a sort of a central and vital part of the Apple conference was there. The context sensitivity and what you're doing with content, be it making it just an easier workflow.
Context sensitivity is definitely a good way to put it. Many would say that there is an example of some copycatting, though. Android has allowed you, types of Android have allowed you to do that reply right there. And even jailbreaking has allowed you to do some of that replying right then and right there. So
Apple does tend to steal a lot of good ideas from jailbreaking apps, from jailbroken apps, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, those jailbroken developers, if there are only way, the only way that Apple could have some sort of like,
thank you for your hard work and effort.
I'm thinking like a way that allows for experimental, like Apple iOS X, experimental development in league with Apple, right? So you're a developer that's jailbreaking today, but Apple actually recruits you to say, okay, you've got good ideas. We've seen your other stuff on, you know, Cydia or whatever. What do we need to do? And that's the way they'd get compensated, right? That's the way you'd lock it in and you'd have whatever. Now, granted, many of these people are independent, but just bring them in as contractors or something. Have some crazy – have a beta program that allows people to mess on the operating system level. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
As opposed to just the test flight level where it's an app sitting on top of the operating system. There's a group of people who are interested in that. There's a group of people who are dedicated to that. And that's a – that's something I think that they could capture all the developers if they went that route. And Android guys would show up there too, you know, because that's one of the reasons why people leave Android, because the customability of iOS is so limited. In Android, it's really not there. You can't customize the OS on that level. I mean, in part, that's for stability. So, yeah, I think this context situation is great. For me, I'm excited about a few things. Hands-free Siri. I'm a little worried about battery life. Things listening all the time, but so be it. I'm sure there'll be some sort of switch there.
So I mean, isn't Android already doing that with OK Google?
With Google Now?
Again,
that's a switch.
Device as well.
Like you have to have a particular device and so on. But I think there's a switch that you can turn that off. It works. I mean, on Android, it works. Again, Apple is doing some copying. But if Siri – I mean, I know that right now one of the things that people were looking for, especially in vehicles, is you're in your car. And you can have a voice activation switch for your iOS stuff. But, you know, that's a rare thing to have. You have to have a pretty new car. But you've got your phone plugged in, so it doesn't matter. And that's really where you want to do your talking to your phone. Siri, what's the score in tonight's Rangers versus Kings game? Siri comes back. You know, the Kings won in overtime. That kind of thing. So I think that the Siri hands-free, that's pretty tight. The Photos app, I mean, you guys know how much I lamented the destruction, the devastation of EverPix and when it died.
Right.
The Photos app is moving closer and closer to EverPix. The idea that your photos can hang out in iCloud. The idea that the editing is seamless and doesn't destroy stuff. I'm just waiting for them to take that EverPix / time hop functionality and keep and highlight me what I was doing last year. The family sharing thing. Right now, my fiance and I, we actually use my login for the App Store and for the Music Store because I don't want to buy stuff twice. Family sharing solves that workaround. So now, as long as we say we're a family, boom, we're good. So that's pretty tight. And the biggest thing for me is this HealthKit situation. I mean,
okay, yeah.
HealthKit is, I mean, the app is called Health. HealthKit is the API that allows developers like Fitbit, Runkeeper, MapMyFitness, you know, Garmin, all these type of people to, it allows all these types of people to push their data into this app for you. So basically, you get in here and you basically log in or give permission for all these apps to drop data in there. And that's huge because right now, you know, I get my Fitbit stats in the Fitbit app and it's beautiful. But, you know, I'm not getting the information I got about my run because the Fitbit device that I use doesn't keep that kind of information in there. It doesn't keep sort of like, am I running or am I walking? It kind of monitors these were active moments, but it doesn't get into that granularity. Meanwhile, there are a couple new devices on the market that are wrist or forearm-based heart rate monitors, and I want to get into using those, but I've always been hesitant, not because the technology doesn't work, but because I don't know how to get that data integrated with the other data that I'm taking in. And then you've got things like on my bicycle, I've got a force and power meter, Edge 500 computer, and I want to be able to take that data and also pump it in to one dashboard, one interface, one place that I could see kind of how my stats are. How's my heart rate when I'm doing this stuff? Is it borderline? Is it problematic? Whatever. So this is huge. And it's huge also because on the back end, you know, they're working with the Mayo Clinic and that'll be, you know, that's the beginning of hospitals taking this data. But there's a point at which, you know, young doctors or just doctors in general, being able to pull up your stats, being able to get an alert when something happens to their patient, being able to see that you're nominally out of line with everybody else, that's a big deal. That's a deal that moves the ball forward in terms of maintaining health instead of just solving problems when they arise. And another big thing there too is that if anonymous usage statistics can become a part of this situation, and they have access to the data of all these people who are trying to stay fit or not. We begin to move toward the singularity in a big way. You begin to see how people are living their lives, and you begin to see how people can optimally live their lives, and that's huge. And Apple is one of the few companies that can tell Fitbit and Y Things and Garmin, hey, get all your data on our system, because those guys don't have an incentive to do it otherwise. So this is huge. This to me is possibly ground shaking if it takes off. We'll see how it develops.
You think this is a precursor to an upcoming device announcement?
I don't know. So we look at how others have like looked at this space, the wearable space. And again, Apple's behind on the wearable space, but maybe that's by design. They're sitting there and they're looking at some new markets that have emerged. We'll get into the HomeKit stuff later, but this connected home, you know, between the Nest and I have a Piper and I use a Wemo and I have a couple and I have a, you know, a Wink, you know, some of that quirky stuff going on in my house. And we look at the fitness space, and it's not too late for Apple to jump into either of them. But does Apple really want to make a million different little tiny devices that they have to manage supply chains for, that they're gonna ask consumers to pay far more money for than the guys who are making them? Or does Apple want to take the data and do what Google does and organize it? And for that, they're going to be becoming the centralized cloud-based hub of all the activity that's going on. And because this centralized cloud-based hub is available on your iPhone, you're more likely to have that lock-in and want to stay with an iPhone. To me, that's like the strategic move that I'm seeing here. Instead of Apple saying, I'm going to make a watch and I'm going to displace Pebble and those guys, they could do that. That's possible. That's fine. But it's stronger for them if they enforce competition across the people in the wearable space and get all those people to want to throw their data up on this healthcare situation so that you have the best possible experience regardless of the device that you're choosing to wear. It also shows that if they make a device, a watch, suppose it has all the doohickeys, a heart rate monitor, all these things in it, that's going to be great. But I can still get all that from HealthKit with the devices that I want. And that means that I don't necessarily feel compelled to get them. So if they're going to go for the watch, this is not a way that this is not a way necessarily that makes the watch a more compelling device because Apple's made it. So I don't know. I think that they're taking that box.com solution of using the APIs instead of making the apps, you know. Whereas Dropbox likes to make the app that you use, box.com likes to allow you to hook every other app into it in a big way. That's kind of their complete focus, and I think that's what they're doing here with the health stuff, especially because they're tapping into this Mayo Clinic and all these other hospital organizations around the country, which I think is going to be – is the transformative part of what we're looking at.
So three major announcements for the developers. One was extensions, widgets, and inter-app communication, HomeKit for iPhone control of your home, and Swift, which is a new programming language entirely. I have to be honest, I'm a little like fuzzy on the intricacies of Swift because it's just above my head as far as programming. But apparently it's a more efficient fork of Objective-C.
Yeah, let's pop into Swift pretty quickly. So right now when you build an app, you're going to be using Objective-C as your scripting language, right? Objective-C is language that sits behind the app, you know, making it go. Google has their own scripting language out called Golang. Well, it's called Go. You look it up on the internet, looking up Go is not going to get you very far, so you type in Golang, Lang for language. Right. But the kind of old school one that's been around and is incredibly powerful is Python. You look at Python, you look at Objective-C, and they're both very good at what they do, but they're also old. And to quote my buddy Dennis, that Apple's been putting bolt-on fixes to C for quite some time, getting C to work with the new landscape of mobile apps. Swift is a new scripting language that Apple's deploying, allowing developers to use in order to move more quickly, to make these apps for iOS devices more quickly. And with that, there are some pros and cons. First of all, when it comes to the pros, Apple, again, like I mentioned with the HealthKit stuff, Apple wants you to buy their devices. How do they do that? Hey, everything works with our stuff. Hey, I'm going to make one device form factor for 2 years, so all the manufacturers of third-party accessories are going to dig down and make all the accessories you'd ever want for an iPhone because they know that they can sell the same thing for 2 years in a row. Contrast that with Samsung and with the Nexus devices made by LG. So Apple's about supporting their phones with, you know, they've got their ecosystem, but then they've got an ecosystem that exists around them. Of third-party manufacturers that want to get in here. The biggest third-party manufacturer are the developers. And the developers, more I think more than developers complained about Objective-C, I think when you're in Apple and you're working and you're a software engineer for Apple and you're putting together these things, they began to find shortcuts. They began to find ways to do things more quickly. And I think if we looked into it, that's where Swift came from. An initiative to be able to get these apps up and running without the problems that C presented. Apple did this when they first, you know, Apple did something similar when they first released the iPhone. There were apps on the iPhone, but you couldn't develop for them. They used these apps. They used whatever infrastructure they put together, and then they figured out how to package it into a software development kit and roll it out to developers under iOS 2. right? I think that's pretty much what's happened here. People were in Apple were using C, Objective-C. They were using it, and they were finding these issues. And over time, management said, let's find a better way. They created Swift for them, and then they pushed it out to developers. Apple is famous for saying, we like to build the products that we want to use ourselves. And I think that's where Swift comes from. So it's helpful, but in some ways, it's not helpful. And it's not helpful because it's not an open language like C is. It's not an open language like Python is.
Right.
It's not a language that someone can write once and run anywhere. It doesn't have that functionality. So that's an issue. But I'm not sure that that matters to Apple. Again, getting the best apps on their devices and getting them as quickly as possible, that's a big deal for Apple. They want developers to run to them. And if it's easier to make an app, then developers are going to run over. We look at the apps that Apple features on the iOS store, App Store. These are apps that are exclusively in Apple. Instagram used to be up there, but when Instagram went to Android, they take it down. They push the apps that are exclusively Apple apps. And they want developers to get their own level of lock-in. Hey, man, why would I develop for Android? It's so much easier to develop for Apple. And it's been easier for years to develop for Apple. Android's SDK is better by leaps and bounds than what it was back in 4 years ago when Gingerbread was the big deal. But Apple's always had this Xcode thing, this developer environment that's allowed people to really get the most help possible. Mm-hmm. Not only did they release Swift for developers, they released an incredibly robust book about Swift, the ins and outs, as it were, sitting on top of the the iBook store for free. So for free, you get basically Swift for dummies, just like you would have gotten C++ for dummies or something back in the day. And Apple's really doing that. In addition, they've attacked Amazon a little bit on this side, this developer side, by creating this this iCloud, this back-end iCloud thing. So you can run your services on iCloud now with iCloud servers if you're a developer. So this also helps the whole developer thing. They're focused on having developers jump into Apple, stay in Apple, have the best experience in Apple, and make their money on Apple. Not just because they get 30% of sales of apps and in-app purchases. That's not really a focus for them. But the better apps they get, the more people buy their devices, the more people buy their devices, the more money that they make. And the more they can differentiate from Google, the more they can differentiate from the other guys. So this is where Swift comes from, and we're going to see. I mean, I talked to a few developers, one of which I'm very close friends with. And, you know, some of the consensus seemed to come out of there that, and these, you know, many of these guys are Android guys, that in the short term, Apple may do very well with this. But in the long term, as app developers wish to expand other platforms, they're going to see that it's better to write in something that's open and they can, you know, they can push to multiple types of platforms. And you can't do that with Swift. So that's something to think about.
Let's talk briefly about the thing that I was really excited about, which is called HomeKit. HomeKit allows iPhones to start controlling smart devices such as garage door openers, lights, security cameras, and it can all be controllable through Siri. So you could say, you know, for example, get ready for bed, and your home could automatically dim its lights and lock its doors. So I think this is huge. This is essentially turning your iPhone into a remote control for home automation.
But it has been that for a little while now.
But you've always had to sort of workarounds to get that to happen. Or you've had to have it happen through the manufacturer's individual apps.
That's not true. Revolve has been around for more than a year, and those guys have basically taken the connected home space and they've treated it like Logitech's Harmony. So, and I feel like we've talked about Revolve before on the show.
Sure, sure. But that's a third-party service.
Exactly. Just like how your Harmony is a third-party device to your television set, your VCR. I said VCR. I'm sorry. But it's a third-party thing, the Logitech Harmony. But it doesn't mean that you don't set up activities. And essentially, this Siri HomeKit thing is setting up activities.
Yeah.
It's doing that. And Revolve has already done that.
But it's going to be a tighter integration because it's directly from Apple.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't think anybody knows if it's going to be a tighter integration because it's directly from Apple. I think that the Siri functionality is compelling, but we have to be honest. Siri has never worked the way we wanted it to work, ever. No but, one in the world says, man, that Siri kicks Google voice commands.
I don't know that that's true.
Dictation works pretty well. But I've found, for me, that the reminder functionality works pretty well.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, you look at voice command versus Siri, and Google Now and voice command work better than Siri. Siri, you can go online. You can Google it. Siri isn't the bee's knees when it comes to voice command, voice control. It just never has been compared to the competition,
I don't know if it's that's necessarily true. We actually discussed this on my other podcast. One of the main differences that you get with Siri's voice automation, and these are actually, funny enough, I was talking with some very
And let's be clear that
Android users.
You're not going to confuse Siri with dictation. Because they're very different.
Right. We're not talking about dictation now. We actually, funny enough, we spent a good 20 minutes saying the exact same thing to Siri and Google Now and seeing what the results were, which was very interesting and kind of enlightening. But I think one of the things that Apple has done well with Siri is incorporate other sorts of applications and allowed those apps to leveraging of Siri via the apps, while Google tends to do things a little bit more insular, using things like Google Search as well as their cards. And so sometimes you do get some more sort of robust
launch any app on Siri, but when you ask Siri a question, the applications that get accessed by Siri have been handpicked by Apple.
Right.
Even though right now you look at
but that list is growing also.
Well, maybe that list is growing, but it's still handpicked. What we just saw with Touch ID, which is, I think, like Siri, one of those just special Apple only things, is that they basically put a kit together so anyone can take advantage of Touch ID, but they still haven't let anyone take advantage of Siri. And I think one of the reasons for that is because Siri it's difficult, one, to differentiate between the operating system and the third party situation. And it's difficult to, and Siri too isn't as precise as they want it to be to just open it up to third party developers. So I'm not dissing Siri.
Right.
I think Siri works. I'm just saying that Siri has never been the be-all, end-all of voice command systems.
I agree that with the be-all, end-all, but I don't necessarily know that there is one currently out. I think what we also sort of discovered is that Siri overall, my assumption was sort of the opposite coming into this. I knew that there were times when I've seen Siri be better and other times I've seen Google be better in my previous tests. But it seemed overall, at least my Android friends on the podcast believed that Siri was actually better at natural language paradigm than Google Now.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard some of that as well. In any event, I look at what Apple's doing and I look at what Revolve's done and I look at the Logitech Harmony, which I think is, for me, the standard of systems integration for a consumer. And I can't gush about the Apple thing that doesn't exist yet. But I can look at Revolve and say, this is a system that works and works well. Now, the cool thing about the HomeKit situation is that it seems like existing hardware platforms with that are backed by tight software on the cloud can now tie themselves into Siri without users having to buy new stuff. And that's kind of tight, right? So like if you have this garage door opener, if you have a Wemo, if you have whatever, you don't necessarily have to buy new stuff in order for it to work with this integration. And that to me is the transformative part of what's going on here. That Apple's saying, hey, you've got your stuff. We're giving you an API so that you can lock in here and do this stuff. Now, you'll notice on the keynote that when they mentioned the thermostat, they did not go with the default de facto super awesome connected thermostat Nest. They went with the Honeywell thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
Two reasons. Obviously, one is that Google owns Nest now. But also, the Honeywell API is open, and the Nest one seems to be limited right now. In any event, I think that Apple's going to make that iPhone much more part of your life if they get this system working and working well. I don't expect that in iOS 8 it'll be fantastic, but I do expect that by iOS 9 it'll be pretty damn good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so anything else about WWDC, iOS 8, OS X, the developer stuff before we move on?
Well, I mean, the only thing I would mention is that for me, you know, I've seen other WWDCs, and this seemed to be one of the more funnier ones.
Yeah, where
Apple is trying to make jokes not only at Google but also at itself, and just having a trying to have a good time. So I heard a lot more laughs than I typically do.
The mourning period is over.
Yeah.
The legacy of Jobs remains, but the mourning period is over. Tim Cook's still wearing a black shirt with respect. But I mean, they I think they stepped up the jokes throughout throughout the entire presentation, which was what part of what made it so good. You've got the guy sitting in there using Spotlight and doing the markup and saying, "I hope this rope is multi-threaded," because he's a developer and he cares about that kind of thing. And you heard the groans and everything. And then later on, they had the pre-made, sort of like mashup of the bald Johnny Ive with the hair of Federini.
That was
pretty funny. Just because those two men work on opposite sides, not opposite, but the two different sides, the two main pieces of the business. Ive working on the design, Federini working on the functionality. So that was for anyone who's an Apple insider, that was particularly interesting. I don't know if the pre-produced Federini with the crazy wig on was necessary.
It did get a little excessively silly sometimes.
Yeah. But I mean, he was on stage for a very long time. This was totally his show this year.
Yeah.
And I think that that definitely made it so that he wanted to add a little humor into it. Again, and you know, he did mention, he did another poke at Johnny Ive's counterpart, talking about when they're camping, the aluminium spoons with the diamond cut
diamond chamfered edges.
Exactly. That was well done. And what that means is basically when you look at an iPhone 5 or 5S or the iPad Air or the iPad Mini, that sort of beveled edge is the diamond cut chamfered edge. So the idea that that'd be on a spoon is particularly interesting. For me, I think that he mentioned some pretty big numbers. There are 300 million people go to the App Store every day. Oh, there are 300 million visits to the App Store every day. There are 200 million iPads in circulation. There are 100 million iPod Touch devices in circulation, which is a bigger number than all the others, because I think if I talk to any geek, most of them are sitting there being like, "Who buys an iPod Touch? Just buy an iPhone." And there's still a market for this device, this non-3G connected device, and they've got 100 million of them out there. 500 million iPhones, half a billion iPhones, way less than Android phones, way less, but still, that's a lot of devices. And then they got into China, and their inroads into China. This whole China Mobile, these guys have it's like the AT&T of China, and they have 700 million subscribers, literally more than twice the population of the United States. And they've already got 130 million of those guys. That's huge. That's huge inroads. That's money.
Untapped market, and they're tapping it.
So anyone who's been worried about the health of Apple, because Apple doesn't have these stats just sitting around, anyone who's been worried about the health of Apple feels a little assuaged. And, you know, more so than the analysts on Wall Street, they get analyst calls which give them some of this information. But if you're a developer and you hear this stuff, you're squirming in your seat because you want to get at all those eyeballs. If you're an advertiser sitting in that space, you're squirming in your seat because you want to get at all those eyeballs. There are a lot of people using these devices. The fact that, you know, 100 million iPod touches, half a billion iPhones, and 200 million iPads, that's 800 million iOS devices in circulation. That means that there are 800 million devices that you could use the platform of which to get your message out there, your app out there, your marketing message out there, whatever. That's the kind of thing that you say at a developers conference to get the people who build the stuff that fuels your sales excited. And I think that was good. And those numbers are bigger than the numbers of the previous year, and they're much bigger than the numbers of the year before the previous year.
All right. Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka. When the alien mimics invade, Keiji Kiriya is just one of many recruits shoved into a suit of battle armor called a jacket and sent out to kill. Keiji dies on the battlefield only to be reborn each morning to fight and die again. On his 158th iteration, he gets a message from a mysterious ally, the female soldier known as the Full Metal Bitch. Is she the key to Keiji's escape or his final death? So this is a very popular manga, was a popular novelization of the manga, and now it's a movie called Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. Opens this Friday as you hear this podcast. And here's the opportunity to check out the story before you go see the movie.
Yeah, you know, I looked into this film, and I gotta say, I saw the trailer when I was watching a few movies this weekend. And does anyone else get the feeling that it's kind of like a StarCraft trailer? If there were a StarCraft movie, they'd be wearing those exoskeletons
and
fighting
and
the
true.
Blood. And yeah, they'd be fighting the Zerg wearing exoskeletons. Only in the movies, the exoskeletons can never really cover the head because you got to have those faces out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw that. All I could think about was StarCraft and the need for Blizzard to produce a StarCraft movie because I would see it no matter what.
It's like StarCraft meets Groundhog Day.
Yes. Thank you. That's right. Exactly what it is. And I just hope it has the humor. Even if it doesn't mean to have the humor, if it has the humor, that's going to be good. I got to say, I've enjoyed the recent Tom Cruise, last like 10, 15 years of Tom Cruise sci-fi movies.
You know, I was thinking the exact same thing earlier this week because I really enjoyed Oblivion, the film that he did last year.
Yeah, Oblivion is basically a mashup of the last 45 years of science fiction. Like, yeah, he managed to put it all into one.
a lot of homages to very popular science fiction.
It's one big remix. And it was comforting. It may not have been groundbreaking, but it was certainly comforting, and I would see it again, no doubt.
I thought it was okay. I thought Oblivion was okay.
Movies are blowing me away. I'm just saying that they entertain me, and they're pretty cool, and I could watch them more than once.
Yeah, I've heard good things about Edge of Tomorrow. I've heard good things about Edge of Tomorrow. So,
yeah, some early reviews are very positive at this point. Yeah,
that's good. And so I do want to check out All You Need Is Kill. So
yeah,
I'm gonna hop on Audible. I think you guys should too.
Same thing. I'm going. It's definitely on my list. I'm gonna see if I can try and get the manga to check it out as well before the movie.
Don't forget to read it backwards. I didn't do that once and spoiled the whole thing for myself. Spoiled the whole thing.
But you knew how. But you knew everyone was okay at the end, right? Before you. That's the good part about that. So, in any case, to download that free audiobook, All You Need Is Kill, or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Using that URL helps us out on the show. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and then we're going to do like a lightning quick run through of the top headlines other than the Apple WWDC for the week. Does the NSA have your face on file for facial recognition? Take a listen to this and come on back.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me and I want all the world to see we've met. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. La-da-da-da-da. Falling, yes, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I have never known the like of this. I've been alone and I have missed things and kept out of sight. But other girls were never quite like this. Da, da, da. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. Yes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Last week, we discussed Apple's purchase of Beats for its streaming service. Amazon, the internet's largest retailer, is making an aggressive move into the booming and intensely competitive business of streaming music now. It will expand its Prime membership offerings by adding a stockpile of old and newish music for subscribers to stream on demand. It's scheduled to launch this June or July. And it won't include recent releases, but instead catalogs of songs and albums that are 6 months old and older, which is about fine because that's about how that's about when I start listening to music. It's about 6 months old.
Oh, I thought that you meant when you said older music, and I read that, and I first read it. I didn't drill down deep into it enough clearly because I thought it was like oldies. When like they said old music,
yeah, they like, just want to avoid some of the hot, like the hot.
I thought they meant stuff from like the 80s, like oldies.
Like I'm sure that'll be in there station. As well. It's going to work across multiple devices and allow users to search and play songs as many times as they want. So that's a nice feature. You know, they've got, basically Amazon's got to jump into the game because everyone else is doing it. Why shouldn't they?
Yeah, no, it's definitely. It's another one of those moves where they just got to chase down. It's interesting that Amazon is quickly building this. It doesn't look like they bought anybody to get it. So that's interesting. But yeah, I mean, they do almost everything else. It's about the big four. You can put your music on it. You can stream, you know, songs that you bought, that kind of thing. But now they're just letting you have basically the radio station functionality that everybody else has.
Yeah. In related Amazon news, we discussed a couple episodes ago about Amazon's impending phone, and now we have a announcement as to when it's being released. June 18th, which is coming up here, about 14 days from when we're recording this. So,
16 cameras, 4.7 inches,
yep.
Boom.
Yep, another competitor in the marketplace. That's always good.
Yeah, great for the consumer.
Moving on here. So Samsung and Facebook's Oculus VR unit are working together to create a virtual reality device powered by Samsung's Galaxy S5 line of phones. Oculus is handling the software side of the product while Samsung handles the hardware. Rather than having its own screen, though, Samsung's VR headset will use your Samsung phone directly. It'll plug into an existing port on the phone and become the screen. The headset itself will have built-in sensors, so any motion tracking functionality is offloaded from the phone processor. This is an interesting development because essentially, I don't know if these are conceptual pictures on this article in Gadget or not, but it looks like the phone will just slip into a plastic sort of housing, which will probably have, as it mentioned, some offboard sensors. But it's a really sort of low-tech way of solving this issue.
Phone as everything. I mean, the idea here is that you don't need to buy a separate device. Your phone will just hop in there and get it done for you. So on one level, it's low tech, but on another level, it's pretty high tech because if it's going to be any kind of a convincing experience, the software is going to be really, really powerful in order to run this on the phone and run it well.
So yeah, I'm curious what it also does to your battery life.
Oh,
yeah,
I mean, part
of me is hoping that it, you know, like you have to charge up the actual device. It's not just a piece of plastic that has a circuit board and it has its own battery action. So hopefully you're using the charge from the device, and if it has any extra, it can go back to your phone because that's really what – or at least not deplete your phone, you know?
Yeah. Imagine the beta tests when those things, like, start sparking inside.
Or the lithium right on your face. There's a battery in there.
What's interesting about this is that everything that it looks like this Samsung version of the Oculus VR – can do, it's capable in on iPhones as well. It's just Samsung went forward and they were the first ones to do this. Hey, we've got the accelerometer, we've got the camera, we've got the high definition screen. Let's put all of those things together in a way that creates a low tech VR headset.
Experience. Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to give it to them for, you know, trying to get more out of the phone. Just like how Apple's doing with the HomeKit and Apple's doing with the HealthKit, they're trying to get people onto their devices too, Samsung. And if they can sell yet another device, they're selling this Oculus Rift thing. Yeah. Oculus gets some money out of this. Facebook gets to strengthen their relationship with Samsung, which is always good considering Facebook has had its own phone and other hardware desires in the past. And Samsung gets people chasing down the Galaxy, right? The only thing I could throw at criticism here is that since Galaxies have the form factor for just one iteration, 1 year, buying this device, whatever it costs, is only going to be useful on this particular phone. You can't buy it for your iPhone 5 and then use it with your iPhone 5S. You know what I mean? You can't buy it for your Samsung S4 and use it for your S5. That's unfortunate for Samsung owners, but you know that's what they choose for. So.
Moving on here, one of the founders of the file sharing website Pirate Bay has been arrested in Sweden to serve an outstanding sentence for copyright violations after being on the run for nearly 2 years. Peter Sunday had been warned by Interpol since 2012 and fined for breaching copyright laws. The Swedish National Police Board has been looking for him since then, and he was given 8 months in jail, so he has to serve out his sentence. It's just notable because it's Pirate Bay and it's Peter Sunday, it's for copyright violations.
Yeah, I've watched the Pirate Bay AFK Away From Keyboard documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's pretty interesting and compelling to kind of hear his side of the argument as well as learn a little bit more about who this specific individual is. And with that sort of backing, I do feel, you know, kind of saddened for you know, his arrest. But this story just continues. The story will never go away. The story will never go away.
Yep.
Well, I don't know. I feel like he's been running. He got caught. If Sweden's catching the Pirate Bay guys, then the whole shebang is up. Because those guys had, like, you know, they're right next to Finland, and there's, like, the whole pirate party and all that stuff like that. So this jig might be up. This way of making money might be up.
Well, interestingly enough, Pirate Bay, like, the site itself was unaffected. It's,
yeah.
They still... Right. They advertise themselves as the world's most resilient website, and that is still apparently
true. How many URLs have they had now?
This is true. Like, they do,
you know, they move around, you know.
But they've really, if you watch the documentary, it's kind of compelling to hear how they've constructed their infrastructure so that they can literally just spin it up in, you know, a matter of minutes. So it's pretty amazing architectural wise.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, if nothing, the Pirate Bay is resourceful. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are pirates, right?
yes. Okay, so Google announced this week that it will soon release a Chrome plugin that will enable end-to-end encryption for web-based email services. It's based on the OpenPGP encryption standard. It will allow anyone to enable encryption through their existing web-based email provider. Google notes that about 65% of messages from Gmail to other providers are encrypted, compared to only about 50% from other services to Gmail. This is forthcoming. I think this is interesting because they're basically addressing a couple of things, like the need for increased encryption. And I think this is directly a direct response to the recent leaks about the NSA's siphoning the Google data.
Why, if it's a plugin for Chrome, but Chrome gets updated like once a month, so why not just put it in Chrome in the next iteration? Why make it a plugin? That to me, I mean, I guess if it's an emergency, plug it in. But it's interesting to me that that's not just built into Chrome as a standard function of the privacy and everything else that Google is pretty good about. So, yeah. But, yeah, this is clearly a move that is tied to the current zeitgeist around the NSA and looking into everything.
Speaking of the NSA and looking into everything, the New York Times reported this week that NSA is harvesting huge numbers of images of people from communications intercepts through global surveillance operations for use in facial recognition programs. According to Edward Snowden documents, the NSA intercepts millions of images per day, including about 55,000 facial recognition quality images, which translate into tremendous untapped potential, is their quote. The NSA now considers facial images, fingerprints, and other identifiers just as important to its mission of tracking suspected terrorists and other intelligence targets. They believe that doing this could revolutionize the way they find intelligence targets throughout the world. However, I don't know. I mean, I'm not entirely sure about the legality of this, considering that I don't know if they have the permission to use these images in that way.
I mean, if they're doing it, they probably have some legal rationale. I know that when you look at the resolution for military to authorize military force for the war on terror, it basically says the president can use whatever he needs to use. So he controls the NSA, and the NSA does that. That's how they justify the drone strikes and all that other stuff. So there is some legal authority behind it. This is sketchy.
Yeah, yeah.
This is that Batman The Dark Knight movie,
right,
where he's
right.
Like, Alfred, we're going to hack into everyone's cell phone now. And you're right. Like, really? And this guy in the back of your head and Greg T. Davies' head is like, they can do that.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. So
that is exactly what they're doing.
50,000 a day doesn't seem like a lot, but that adds up over the course of
a year. Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah. And who are these people? And are they terrorists? Suspects? Are they, questionable people? Are they you and me? You know,
it must be the chameleon from Machete Kills, because he has all those faces.
I did not see that movie, but I like that you went there.
I believe it's available now on Netflix.
Oh, it is.
Wrapping up our headlines before we jump into the last section of this show here. Once again, with Google plans to spend more than $1 billion on a fleet of satellites to extend internet access to unwired regions of the globe. They're going to start with 180 small, high-capacity satellites orbiting the Earth at lower altitudes than traditional satellites, and they hope to cover the entire globe. These satellites weigh less than 250 pounds. This is like an extension of their, Loon? Project Loon?
Project Loon had these crazy, I don't know if they're crazy, but they had weather balloons basically projecting internet connectivity down to places that didn't have hardwired infrastructure. The satellite thing is clearly a more robust way to do that.
Sure.
It takes it to another level.
Literally.
literally the level above Facebook's plan to use drones to do the same thing.
Right. Think about a satellite as opposed to a drone. A drone needs fuel or electricity to run. And unless these drones are solar powered, that's a problem. Also, drones need propellers to run. Or if they're using electricity, they need propellers. If they're not using electricity, they need fuel because they're using jet engines.
Yeah.
The thing about that is that's maintaining that fleet is a bit more difficult than maintaining satellite connection. Satellite, you put it up in the sky. It's got a few servos that help actuate its, like, you know, telemetry and everything. But at the same time, it's, you know, it gets solar powered, and it doesn't really have to worry about running into stuff as long as it's, like, guided correctly. So you can do more with a satellite. It's just incredibly more expensive to throw it up in the air or the above the air in space. Yeah. So that's a thing. My question is, are they planning on sending, like, microwaves directly from satellites to people's phones? Because that sounds difficult. Right now, you need a specialized satellite phone in order to pull that off. Or are they planning on making the satellites, you know, tie to something on the ground, which then ties to people's phones? I don't know.
Yeah, these are early reports, so we know very little about this at this point. But I imagine that we'll find out more. All right, we're going to take one last break. And when we come back, our thoughts on Silicon Valley, not the region, but the show, and our drill down videos of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuaken. So we've been talking off and on over the last few episodes about Silicon Valley, which is the HBO show created and showrun by Mike Judge of King of the Hill and Beavis and Butthead fame, and also the movies Idiocracy, Office Space. Silicon Valley just finished their season, and I was fascinated by it when we first started. When it first started, we talked about it briefly when they aired their pilot episode, and it seemed fascinating, maybe a little shaky, but now that they've finished up their season, I have to say that I am fully positive on it. I think they have really improved from the sort of C to B grade pilot that they started with, and they've really come out strong. The last three or four episodes have been really, really strong. They've taken place at TechCrunch Disrupt, and you know, our mutual friend and former co-host Devinder Hardawar had complained on line about the lack of of shows or movies that really that like the tech community can really get behind as representative of themselves, and I think I'm trying to remember what he was criticizing.
Well, he started by saying this is a show that everyone's been waiting for. The problem was that review happened before the show really came out. They'd only been the pilot. So it kind of went into the show and it talked about the show without the benefit of having seen the entire season. From my perspective, I look at the show and I see deep, deep flaws in the format, the casting,
really,
the representation of geek culture.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. I'm not a gusher on most things. I do approach, especially like, you know, content with a certain level of criticism, in mind, but I look at Silicon Valley and I think the demographic that they're going after is there, and yeah, they want to hit that. Technology is a huge sector of our economy, which is one of the reasons why, you know, we're all on this show. But I think that what Judge does is he kind of applies this toilet humor standard to something that could be bigger and better than that, right? I feel like I'm watching an episode of Workaholics that just happens to be about technology developers. With some bits of inside jokey stuff about the culture thrown in. But I don't feel like I'm represented, or any of my friends who are developers in Silicon Valley are really represented. And that representation goes into not only the understanding of, you know, what they're covering on the show. I think that they did a reasonable job of, you know, finding a good piece of technology, a good aspect of technology to cover. You know, it's not all like BS, like when you watch any movie about hacking. But I don't think that they represent Silicon Valley demographically. Northern California demographically. I know a lot of people who code who can talk fine and speak well, and I feel like they've retreated back into the stereotype of the coder who doesn't understand how to communicate effectively, who has trouble with girls and all that stuff. And I think it's lazy.
I don't
and
think
it's sloppy, and that's what
so,
I mean.
So okay. So interestingly enough, mm-hmm. You know, I do think that keeping in perspective that it's purely a comedy, and I mean, I
well,
think it definitely
you can keep
could
that in perspective,
do...
but at the same time, this is an HBO show. HBO pushes the envelope. HBO shows us what we can be and what we, and other things like that. HBO
right.
shows us new aspects of things.
I mean,
that's
I think
the successful
it can be...
HBO shows have been. I mean, let's look at this. Like, let's look at this empirically. Look at The Sopranos. Look at The Wire. Look at Game of Thrones. These are things that push envelopes
well,
on social
okay, but
levels,
if you're going to compare,
and they don't just like
yeah,
okay,
those
look,
are vastly different.
If you're going to make that comparison,
let's not the dramas, and let's look at Veep.
Yeah, yeah, right? that's closer to what
okay,
you're.
Let's
what
look
you're,
at Veep and what Veep does. Yeah. Veep definitely has a caricature-esque aspect to the politics, but Veep does a good job of including a heavy amount of realism. And showing it as satire. And I don't think that Silicon Valley really shows me satire. I think Silicon Valley shows me what Mike Judge, who has experience in the Valley, what Mike Judge thinks that people think geek people are like.
So this is – yeah, it's interesting hearing your perspective on this because I actually – so when going into the show, mm-hmm. you know, I thought the first couple episodes were meh. But as I think the show kind of really developed into its own, and I actually think it's spot on to tell you the truth for living in the Valley here. I think there's – you know, there are a lot of stereotypes and a lot of the characters or archetypes, and but a lot of the aspects that they describe are really spot on for living here in the Valley. And I think they've done a lot of research into what actually goes on. For example,
they've clearly done some research. They've, you know, they talked to people and like Stanford, and they talked to other people.
Even like little details. So for a couple examples of that is, mm-hmm. you know, in one of the episodes they were showing like they had just chips on the table, and I'm like, yep, those are the same type of chips we have at all the offices around the Valley. Like the exact same thing, even though no one was like snacking on it, it was just there. And I read this article which really showed the depth that they went in pursuing the elements that had to deal with TechCrunch that go later on in the season. And
sure.
So the TechCrunch Disrupt thing was clearly, you know, they wanted to bring realism to the Disrupt thing and show, hey, it's not a question of we're just programming some stuff. It actually has to like culminate in this kind of show that's a competition and things like that. I thought that brought a lot of drama, and I think it did get stronger toward the end. But I think, like, from
it
the
was,
beginning,
it was
the premise
realist in TechCrunch Disrupt. Even they
I don't,
even
I,
went
I'm
as
not
far
disagreeing
as
with that part. I'm not disagreeing with that part. I just think that, you know, that's the last two episodes. Up to that point, the only girl is the cute girl. The only girl that has a regular role is the cute girl who doesn't even know how to code. You know, it's taking place in Northern California where the Asian population is present, and the only Asian that's represented is some guy who can't even speak English properly and is made fun of the entire time. You've got the whiz kid on Adderall, which is just a boring piece, although I like the fact that they managed to debunk that myth by saying he was writing nonsense. And I feel like the depiction of some of the characters is just kind of like it wasn't strong. Like they could have done so much better. And that's kind of how I see it in terms of like the demographic problem. When it comes to the stereotype of the geek and the I can't talk, I'm going to stutter about everything. You know, I've been around founders of technology companies that are able to found them because they're able to sell them even before they get salespeople. They're able to take this idea and understand what they want and push it forward. And from my experience over the last, you know, 12, 13 years dealing with technology companies and the people who found them and run them and code them and all the rest of it. These are people who can communicate highly effectively and get out there. And I feel like you've got this house with this dude who doesn't know anything. And then you've got his, you know, his kind of cohorts that are just kind of there to harass him.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's like – I think that's part of Mike Judge's style. I think what you –
And that's why I think it's kind of like it's a, it's not it, – it didn't like touch me like the way Office Space touched me. Because Office Space, I think he captured the monotony of a regular cubicle life really, really well. But then again, I wasn't the biggest fan of Beavis and Butthead. I didn't really get it. But when I look at this, I look at it and I don't see – I don't see the – the most realistic layout of this startup world, which I am immersed in.
Well, interestingly enough, I kind of say the opposite there. I see a lot of elements that I'm like, yep, I've seen that. And it just makes me laugh because I can I relate it to things I've seen in, so far in my
– Some of the details are great. I'm not going to deny that. I just feel like we're talking about different things. You're talking about some of the details, the chips, the this, the that. I'm talking more about the characters that actually pull this stuff off.
But I still mean some of like the social aspects that they refer to in terms of the various like they're you know one of the things we were talking about before is like oh TechCrunch always runs whatever sort of articles and they've sort of referenced that and you know unless you're
again I'm not going to deny the TechCrunch pieces though those were the best pieces of the show, but when you talk about strength of character, layout of like realistic demographics of the area, and the fact that you know everyone who goes is just or like you know you're at the beginning of Disrupt and you've got this girl who like is just chewing gum and asking boys to code for her, things like that. These are the things that stick with me and turn me off to the show. These kind of like stereotypes of like who's capable of what. That I think actually hit our culture and reinforce some of the issues in our culture that aren't there, especially at a time when Silicon Valley is actively trying to recruit more different types of people. And they don't have to when it comes to Asian people as much as Caucasians, recruit women, especially in a climate where, you know, women's rights vis-a-vis the workplace are a big thing. We've got these kind of like dandy, I just help handle this guy, Gavin, whatever, because he's like so ridiculous. Yada yada yada. I just didn't gel with it because, again, I've met some of the personalities that started some of the coolest stuff around, and this doesn't jive. Now, the whole like let's pack in sort of an Asperger-y, Bill Gatesy type person with whatever, you know, there's that. But I just felt as if you know he was going easy in order to get some cheap laughs that weren't necessary to make a great show. It didn't come across as smart as a Veep. It didn't come across as smart as some of the other stuff that you see in the HBO comedies. It came across as low-hanging fruit.
It's really – I find it really interesting that you say this. First of all, let me say that the show that I was trying to remember that our buddy Devendra was commenting on was not worthy of – the tech community was Halt and Catch Fire, which is AMC's basically AMC's drama set in
the startup
early 80s around the nascent PC market. And I would agree with him there. Like, I feel like that is not very representative of what that AMC is sort of packaging a drama in a setting, but that setting isn't really infused with the real sort of the real sort of life of that era.
Yeah, they're madmenning the AMC. What they're doing with that show is they're taking the Mad Men approach. They're like, we're gonna go back to like maybe the golden age when all this stuff started, when this stuff was going on, and we're going to do that. And I don't think that show certainly isn't as, to me, that show's not as entertaining as Silicon Valley.
But
we talk about Silicon Valley.
I would argue that Silicon Valley really does represent the,
I think Silicon Valley represents a certain aspect of today. I think they got better at it as time went on, but I think that the fundamental pieces of it,
but
the,
I would say
the main characters are not necessarily representative of reality, and they're not entertaining to me. Like,
I would
I'm
also
not
argue
by
to
seeing
your
this guy
dribble down and fall on the floor, and I can't, like, all this stupidness, like, oh, I can't breathe. And then the guy's like, oh, wait, you know, it's not the best thing to say to somebody who's having a panic attack, but, you know, we have to hurry. Like, it's just cheap jokes. It's not funny. It's also like going to a bad comedian.
To your point, though, I don't feel like the characters are homogenous. I feel like there's some definite discrete characters. They're not all stereotypical. They're not all the same, of cut from the same cloth. That you have different types of characters there, and there may not be the sort of you. I think you criticized the racial
diversity. Okay, so you have a Satanist, you have your typical geek guy who can't talk or communicate, and you have your super stereotypical Indian dude that codes.
Yeah,
right. That's your main three, and then you've got sort of the one offs like the dude who's running the house. Who's Mr. Talky Talk and no action, and your super other stereotype, the Asian kid who can't speak English, and then you've got your two kind of like Steve Ballmer, Bill Gates dudes that are running the big shows, right?
I feel like you're
all
like,
of it is characters.
Like what you're reacting to is basically sort of a what's rubbing you the wrong way is the Mike Judge sense of humor in general, and not necessarily
Office Space was a fantastic movie that captured that space wonderfully. I mean, here's the bottom line.
But
Silicon Valley is 8 episodes long. Yeah. It's not going to kill you to check it out. If you don't like it, you won't like it. I looked at it, and I look at it in terms of like as part of like the literature of our time, trying to capture the zeitgeist and a big, you know, a relevant piece of today's tech culture.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's doing a great job at that. I think we've been incredibly starved for a piece like this. We've been incredibly starved for a startup focused, whether it's a comedy or a dramedy or whatever. And we haven't had one yet. And this is as good as it's gotten so far. I just don't think it's that great on its own as it is. And especially when you put it in the context of HBO's other stuff.
I personally like it a lot. I feel like if this is the best that we have gotten so far. If you compare it to something like Halt and Catch Fire,
it's above Halt and Catch Fire. I just think that it's based on shaky ground. I hope that next season they come out with, you know, some characters that are more robust. I hope that next season they come out with some characters that are frankly smart. I hope that the dialogue can be smarter, you know? I think the one smart thing I saw that really like was semi interesting, but semi predictable was the whole like poppy seed hamburger, yada, yada, yada thing. Right. That was somewhat interesting. And you got some depth of a character, but I kind of feel like I'm watching Seinfeld 16 years later when it comes to these kind of caricatures of people. And I'd rather see something with characters, mm-hmm. real characters.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I enjoy it a lot. I've had a lot of laughs, and I've actually watched it regularly. It's one of those shows that I've almost watched every week in and out. I thought the first initial episodes were a lot weaker, and I didn't find it as funny or relatable in certain circumstances with what I personally see or interact with in the Valley, but I think it's pretty good. I mean, I do understand. Like, I think to a certain extent there are single dimensions to some of the characters, but I actually do think that they do have a little bit more depth than you give them credit for at times. And you know, I think the way this season is set up, I feel like is more of a – I think the season itself has very firm closure in the case that there couldn't be other seasons. I think this is a standalone season, and that's how it was built. And that potentially could be an effect on, you know how the what the characters are like, given that for me, without going into spoilers,
if this is a standalone season,
the show ends sort of how it begins, with a particular scene. The show kind of ends how it begins, kind of setting it up that, hey, if you know Mike Judge doesn't get the funding he needs or the metrics he needs, the show
we've come full circle.
Right, right. There's no need to go forward. I hope they go forward.
I do too.
And if
so
they
here's
do,
the thing. I hope they go forward too, because I think that there's way more that a show like this could offer if they do it right. I'm not saying that I am sorry to see it go, throw it out. I'm just saying I'm disappointed because I think that they focused on tropes and stereotypes. And I, contrary to you guys, I don't think that the characters were very strong. They might have had a highlight of a moment in one instance or another, but you simply haven't seen it. The guy who's playing the main character as an actor, I think he's done quite a good job. I just don't think he's had a lot to work with. Mm-hmm. So do I think that Silicon Valley should go off the air and go away? No. I think I'd like to see it refactored. I'd like to see Mike Judge do something far better when it comes to this space. Anybody, really. But I think Mike Judge has what it takes. I just think he, you know, I don't know. I felt like I was being shortchanged for the Mike Judge brand, the HBO brand, and so on and so forth.
It was smart that they
locked it in, that they said, okay, it's 8 episodes. If it ends and we don't come back, at least there's some closure. I think that everybody should do their first season like that today, in an age where we have the kind of metrics and digital demographics. You can bet that this show was watched more on HBO Go than it was on HBO being aired. And so, I think you have to like make sure that your show wraps up season per season, because you can't necessarily expect that you'll get renewed, especially when you have digital metrics behind it.
Yeah, that's true. I would love to hear what any of our listeners have to think about this show. So.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, if you have any opinion, if you've seen this, if you've got HBO and you've seen the whole season or just a couple episodes, you know, write us. We'd love to hear your opinion on this. All right, let's just briefly talk about. We have a couple of videos this week which we will post in our show notes, and I think they're both worth watching. First one is one that you linked to me, Dwayne. It was Kids React to Old Computers. Now, this is a sort of a running feature by the Fine Brothers, who've been doing sort of this Kids React to and Teens React to and Old People React to. And I think this one was actually a response to AMC's premiere of Halt and Catch Fire. And it's basically kids looking at old computer tech and sort of letting them explore how we did things back in the day when we didn't, before we had any sort of, you know, before the Pentiums, as it were. It's worth checking.
Yeah, it's good. It gives you an idea of how lucky we are.
Yeah.
how far we've come.
Many of our listeners may not even have lived through this old tech as I did. And I don't think you guys lived through this old tech, did you? I think this may be before your guys' time.
Yeah, some.
I mean, I played with those machines. You know, I remember running games and things of that nature, and it was a learning experience. Kids these days just have it so much simpler.
Yeah, absolutely. Be thankful for what you got, for sure. And the last thing is a clip from Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which is a terrific show. John Oliver has sort of taken the reins in his own show from Jon Stewart's show, except he's doing it on HBO on a weekly basis, sort of the same comedy news format. And we've been talking about net neutrality for the last few weeks in relation to the FCC's new changes that came as a result from ISP lobbying. And John Oliver basically boils down the entire net neutrality issue in basically 7 minutes, but does it like in a really humorous way. So if you're still confused about the FCC's new changes and how this will directly affect you, I highly recommend watching this clip from Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
Yeah, you know, what John Oliver has done, I mean, I'm sure John Stewart's a little sad that he can't pass the show on to John Oliver now because he's moved on to HBO.
Yeah.
But what I think he's done is he's managed to find a way to pick maybe one issue a night. He did one on global climate change the other day. And they're really YouTubeable moments, really YouTubeable moments, yeah, where he spends several minutes, kind of Rachel Maddow style almost, mm-hmm, going into an issue
and then pulling up, then doing the John Stewart thing where he pulls up every bit of media that's necessary to move it forward. And I think that he's taking kind of a highly editorial approach, where John Stewart takes less of an editorial approach and kind of is more indicative and highlighting the craziness around something. This guy's got an opinion. He had one on the death penalty. He had one on climate change. Now he has one on net neutrality. And I think it's pretty interesting to see how he's growing into this role. This is definitely one to watch. And the trailer, the sort of like the promotion for Last Week Tonight, because it's a Sunday show. It just happens at nighttime, just sort of like Meet the Press or Fox News Sunday or whatever. Yeah. It's brilliant because he talks about it. He basically breaks down what all the Sunday shows are in a big joke. And it's pretty clever. So this show is definitely one worth watching.
All right. I think that's going to do it for this show, with the exception of going around the table here. I'm going to start with Dwayne. Where can we find your work when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. You can also see some of my work on thedrilldown.com. And it looks like I'll be throwing some stuff up on a couple other sites, so I'll let you know when that happens.
How about you, Tosin? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find the other podcast at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And finally, you can find R2D2 stuff at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Facebook and Twitter at MrBabyMan. As for the Drill Down, if you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on that site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience, by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location, and where I will be running home from E3 to record our podcast. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.